be in as much pain as before, but he certainly wouldn't be doing any dancing any time soon. But then, to Alesh's mind, the priests made a career out of being wrong. Was it really any surprise that the same people who believed Amidan was a kind, compassionate being who cherished mankind would also be wrong about the afterlife? A popping sound came from behind him, and Alesh groaned with the effort of turning a head that seemed to have grown 100 times heavier in the last few hours. A grey-robed figure knelt in the grass, turned away from him. Alesh tried to speak, but all that came out was a weak cough. He took a moment to steady himself, then tried again.
"Who are you?"
he rasped, and was shocked by how frail his voice sounded. The figure did not respond, but remained hunched over a small fire. There was something familiar about the scene, the grey robes, the hiss and pop of the fire, something achingly, naggingly familiar. Then, with a shock, Alesh knew what it reminded him of, and he felt his blood go cold. If he'd ever doubted he was dead, there was no doubting it now. For there, knelt in the grass, only a few feet away from him, his robes the same dull grey as the smoke that drifted and curled above him, like fingers grasping at the air, was the Keeper of the Dead. Stories of the Keeper, the soulless creature that was said to escort the recently dead to the afterlife, ran through his mind in a panicked, confused jumble, until one half-remembered phrase from some old nursery rhyme rang in his head with the finality of a funeral bell. "And the fire's red. He keeps it hot for those who are dead and those who are not. If you don't see him, wait a while. He's up ahead, a foot, a mile, waiting, watching, his brand in hand. You may run or crawl, sit or stand, but no man ever leaves his land." Goose flesh rose on Alesh's skin, and he watched the grey-robed figure, fear and wonder mingling in his mind. It was said that the Keeper marked the dead with a burning brand, so that they could never again be allowed back into the world of living. "No," he thought desperately, "I don't believe in the gods." But, believe it or not, one was knelt in front of him, and there was no arguing with that. Panic seized him, and he tried to lift himself up again. He'd barely risen a few inches when white-hot agony shot through his battered body, and he fell back to the ground, gasping in pain. The figure went still, then slowly began to turn. Suddenly, Alesh wanted anything but to see the figure's face, to look into the eyes of a being who served as eternity's warden, but he found that he couldn't look away, no matter how hard he tried. He was frozen, terrified, and yet overcome with a sick curiosity. When the figure finally did turn and look at him, Alesh gasped in surprise.
"Priest?"
he asked, when he was finally able to speak.
"Is that really you?"
The old man smiled, a twinkle in his eyes, and as he walked closer, Alesh realized that what he'd expected to be a fiery brand was actually a steaming bowl of stew. The priest knelt beside him, and as the smell of the stew wafted into his nose, Alesh found that he was ravenous. He tried to reach for the bowl, but his arm wouldn't answer his call, and he cursed quietly at his own weakness. For his part, the priest only smiled and withdrew a tin spoon from the bowl.
"Slowly,"
he said, his voice soft and kind. Alesh was struck with a memory of how he'd tried to leave the man, and his face heated as guilt washed over him in a wave.
"It's all right,"
the priest said, patting his arm reassuringly as if he'd read his thoughts.
"But go slowly."
Alesh nodded weakly, and the man began to spoon the stew into his mouth. It tasted better than he remembered anything ever tasting, and he swallowed eagerly, nodding for more, his hunger pushing the questions he wanted to ask from his mind. The priest continued to feed him patiently, but despite Alesh's hunger, he wasn't able to eat more than half of the bowl of stew before his exhaustion overcame him.
"Sleep now,"
the priest said, taking the bowl away.
"And do not worry. I am here."
For once in his life, Alesh's sleep was not plagued by the snarls and growls of nightlings, or the screams of his murdered parents, and he awoke some time later feeling surprisingly refreshed. He was stiff and sore, but the pain, for the most part, was gone. So, too, he noticed upon glancing around the small clearing, was the grey-robed man.
"Priest?"
he asked, in a hoarse, sleep-muddled voice. There was no answer.
"Priest? Are you there?"
The only answer was the sound of the wind in the leafy canopy overhead, and the gentle burbling of the river hidden somewhere behind the thick trunks of the trees. Suddenly, a feeling of dread began to form in the pit of Alesh's stomach. Where could he have gone? Surely the priest wouldn't have left him without a word. Not unless... unless the Redeemers sent more men. Unless they killed him. Alesh slowly started to rise, tensing in anticipation of the pain he'd felt before, but when it came he found that, though still bad, it was manageable, and after some effort he was able to sit up. He shrugged away the wool blanket that had been wrapped around him, and saw that he was bare-chested. His shoulder and chest had been bandaged with strips of white cloth, and similar bandages were wrapped around his legs, where the beast's claws had raked him. He forced himself to remain calm as he surveyed the surrounding woods. He was surprised to see no trace of the Redeemers or the Lightbringer gone. There was not even so much as a patch of disturbed grass to mark that they had been there. It was as if they'd never existed at all. One night spent in the darkness, and just like that, they're gone. It was a depressing thought. The priest's bedroll lay a short distance away by a weakly burning natural fire. If the man had left of his own choice, why would he have abandoned his bedroll?
"Relax," he muttered to himself. "They couldn't have found you already."
But that wasn't true, was it? If the Redeemers and Garn were to be believed, Kael had made finding him a priority, and with the resources of the entire city bent to his bidding, Ilrika's new chosen could afford to send dozens of troops out to hunt him if he wished.
"Ha!"
came a distant shout, and the sound was followed by a loud splash.
"They found him,"
Alesh thought, panicked. He glanced around the clearing, and was surprised to see his sword lying in the grass. He shuffled to it and bent to pick it up. They wouldn't catch him by surprise again. He turned and began limping in the direction of the sound.
"Hold on, priest. I'm coming,"
he thought grimly, clenching his teeth against the shooting pain in his legs. He had to pause after only a few steps to get his ragged breathing under control, and helpless anger flared through him. While he was gasping like a sick old man, the priest was out there somewhere, fighting for his life.
"Night, curse it,"
he thought, and started forward again, dragging the sword along the ground beside him. After what would normally have been a short walk, but what, just then, felt like an eternity, the trees gave way to a river bank.
"Priest!"
he called, scanning the bank for the old man.
"Where are you?"
"Well, good morning."
Alesh turned at the sound of the voice, and was surprised to see the priest standing waist-deep in the river. The grey sleeves of his robe were rolled up to reveal thin, bony forearms, and he had a wide, innocent smile on his face. Alesh swayed, his legs threatening to give way beneath him, as he took a few halting steps toward the edge of the river bank.
"Priest,"
he said, gulping air.
"Are you all right?"
The man's smile widened, something that until that moment Alesh would have thought impossible.
"Of course. And why wouldn't I be?"
Alesh sighed and fell to a sitting position.
"I thought..." "Never mind what I thought. What are you doing?"
The man gestured expansively at the river.
"Getting us breakfast, of course."
Alesh snorted.
"Well, good luck. I don't know a lot about fishing, but I do know that you're supposed to be quiet and not disturb them. You've probably scared them all away by splashing around in there like that."
The priest took a minute to consider this, then gestured to the soft, wet soil on Alesh's side of the river. Alesh looked where the man had indicated, and was surprised to see two large fish lying still on the ground.
"I suppose that those left, then,"
the priest said, amusement in his tone,
"are the bravest, most worthy of their kind. No doubt they will serve well for food on which to break our fast."
Alesh's eyes narrowed.
"I thought you were being attacked."
The priest looked confused.
"By the fish?"
Alesh groaned. "Never mind." The man nodded and turned away. He held his hands out to either side of him, looking up at the sky with a childlike smile of contentment, as if standing in the middle of an ice-cold river was a lifelong dream of his. "Crazy bastard will probably catch cold," Alesh thought, "and it'll serve him right. Here we are being hunted by soldiers, and he's wading in the water like some country kid when his chores are done." He opened his mouth to tell the man to hurry up, then stopped. The truth was, his legs and shoulder ached, and he didn't relish the idea of walking even the short distance back to their camp, not just yet, anyway. It was unlikely that another squad of Redeemers had been sent in the same direction as the others, and even if they had, a minute or two wouldn't make any difference. So instead, he sat and waited. In the light of the new day, with warm sunlight falling across him and the birds whistling their songs overhead, it was almost impossible to imagine that creatures such as the Nightwalkers existed at all, and even harder to believe that he was being hunted down by men who sought his life. After a time, Alesh found himself relaxing, until, almost against his will, he lay on his back, the grass giving beneath him, more comfortable than any nobleman's silken pillow. He lay there, staring at the sky and listening to the soft, gurgling, nonsense speech of the river and the whispery rustle of the trees as they answered. Listening to the sounds of the forest, feeling the warm sun on his skin, Alesh's eyes slowly closed. "Thank you," a voice said beside him, and Alesh grunted with surprise, jerked up out of a near doze. He turned and saw the priest standing over him, that same smile on his face. "Thanks for what?" he asked, annoyed that he'd been so lost in thought that he hadn't heard the man approach. He looked at the priest's empty hands, confused. "Where are the fish?" The old man smiled and gestured to the spot on the bank where another large fish had joined the first two and lay unmoving in the dirt. "They are there and again, thanks." Alesh looked between the fish and the man again, before understanding. "Wait a minute. Surely you can't mean for me to go down there and get them. I'm injured, remember?" The man nodded solemnly, his face a picture of compassion. "I remember. I'll warm the fire." Before Alesh could find the words to protest, the priest had already turned and disappeared into the trees. Alesh shook his head as he stared after him. The man was crazy, that was certain. His stomach rumbled, as if to remind him of the fact that he hadn't eaten yet, and with a curse and a grunt, he levered himself up and started the slow job of working his way down the bank. Some time and several aches and curses later, they sat on their bedrolls, the cooking fish giving off an intoxicating smell that made Alesh's mouth water. The priest was staring at the fire with a small smile on his face, as if it was an old friend that he'd met after years of absence. "What's your name?" Alesh asked, more to keep his mind off of the cooking fish than anything else. The man turned to him and shrugged. "If there is anything I have learned about men, it is that they are more than their names." Alesh rolled his eyes. "I think I liked you better when you didn't talk." He hadn't been with the priest long, but he was beginning to realize that the man had an annoying way of talking a lot without really saying anything. "Well, anyway," he said after a pause, "I need something to call you. I can't keep calling you priest." The man smiled distractedly, turning his attention to the treetops overhead in an expression that Alesh could only describe as wistful. "Priest will do." "Are you a priest?" The man smiled, but did not answer. "Fine," Alesh said, struggling to keep his patience. "So what happened to the bodies?"
"Bodies?"
"Yes," Alesh said, through gritted teeth. "You know, corpses, dead men. The Redeemers and that man gone. What happened to them?"
"Oh," the priest said, nodding. "Those bodies. Well, they're gone."
Alesh pinched the bridge of his nose and forced himself to take a deep breath.
"I know they're gone. I'm asking you where they went." "Away."
The grey-robed man was too focused on the treetops to notice Alesha's flat look.
They're gone. Away.
The priest nodded.
Right.
All right, then, Alesha said. Let's try this a different way. Why did you help me? The man finally turned to him then, studying him as if Alesha was the crazy one.
If I hadn't helped you, you would have died.
Alesha bit back a curse.
That doesn't answer my question.
The man raised a bushy grey eyebrow at him.
Doesn't it?
Okay, fine, Alesha said, unable to keep the annoyance from his voice. But why were you here? The old man gave him a puzzled, worried expression.
Where else should I be?
Alesha grunted in frustration and studied the man.
You can't be si- The fish is done,
the man said with a smile, as if Alesha hadn't been speaking. He rose and began to spoon the hot stew into two bowls, putting a spoon in each. Despite his annoyance, Alesha found himself holding his hands out eagerly as the man handed him his bowl. He took a bite of the still steaming stew, and his eyes widened in surprise.
Wow! This is amazing!
Then, around a second mouthful,
can all priests cook?
The grey-robed man shrugged, a slight smile on his face.
I wouldn't know.
Alesha opened his mouth, paused, thought about it, then shrugged and took another bite of stew. Chapter 38
Well, damn it, fold or play already, will you? Some of us got wives waiting at home for us, and if I'm out much later, I've a better chance of getting stabbed than getting laid.
Rion continued to stare at his cards, barely hearing the man at all.
What was his name again? Ben? Jim? It didn't matter.
What did matter was the hand he was holding. A full set of suns and brands, the best possible hand in the game of Brighters, a hand that any gambler worth his salt would be thrilled to see. If, that was, he hadn't just finished drawing it 9 times in a row. He'd always been lucky, always won more than he lost, but this was something else. Nobody drew 9 branded suns in a row. Nobody. Drawing 1 would earn a man the envy of the others at his table. Drawing 2 would earn him their hatred. Drawing three would earn him a slit throat in some back alley. He stared at the cards for another second, looked resignedly at the coins on the table, sighed, and folded his hand for the 8th time in a row.
Too rich for my blood by half, Jim. I done told you, damn it, it's Tim.
Right, Rion said, thinking of a night not long ago when he'd sat in some other cheap, poor district inn.
He doesn't cheat, Jorin. He's just got a chosen zone luck, that's all.
He kept looking at his hand, half expecting it to change the way the coin had. Would it be the smiling nightling this time, or the torch, the light or the darkness?
Gods, am I going mad?
He glanced up and saw that the man, Tim, was scowling at him.
My apologies. Jim's your brother, right?
If anything, the man looked even more hostile.
I ain't got no brother.
Rion started to speak, paused, and looked at the other 2 men at the table. But if he was looking for help, he was wasting his time. Both men, very large, very intimidating men, he noted, had scowls to match Tim's own. Rion sighed and held his hand up, signalling the serving girl to bring him another ale while Tim collected his coins. Normally, he avoided drink. The last thing a man leading a double life needed was to lose his hold on sense. But tonight, he felt that the drink was the only thing keeping him sane. He was several drinks in now, and drunk enough that he kept having to check to make sure his feet were still there. They went numb when he drank, always had. Drunk or not, from time to time, he thought he heard a sound that he would have sworn was laughter, ringing in his head. It was the man next to Tim's turn to deal. Gods forbid he even try to remember his name. And he watched as the big man handed out the cards. When he was finished, Rion hesitated, staring at them uncertainly.
Well,
Ain't you going to check your hand?
Rian looked up and noticed that the three men were staring at him again, and although he wouldn't have thought it possible, their scowls were even deeper than before. Just how long had he been sitting there, staring at the backs of those cards anyway? He cleared his throat. Yes, of course. He grabbed the cards, wincing as he did, the way a man might wince when he's handling a wild animal and expecting to get bit. Conscious of their eyes still on him, he glanced at his cards. Feeling like a man in a dream, he laid them on the table, face down, and slid them into the center. Laughter, loud and clear, rung in his ears. There, he said, whipping his head around, searching for the source of the sound. There! Did you hear that? The three men glanced at each other as if he'd gone insane.
I didn't hear a damn thing, said one.
Rion's breath felt short, and suddenly he thought he couldn't spend another moment in this shitty inn, in this shitty part of town. He rose, grabbing his threadbare cloak from the back of the chair he'd been sitting in, and pulling it over his shoulders.
What the fuck, man?
The man, Tim, asked.
Ain't nobody even bet yet?
Rian nodded distractedly, a feeling like he was suffocating, beginning to build in his chest and throat.
I'm sorry, but I really must be going.
Well, you damn sure ain't getting your ante back. You can count on that.
Wouldn't dream of it,
Rian said, glancing around the room. His vision was blurry. Just how many had he drank? But it was clear enough for him to see that no one was watching him. No one, at least, that he could see.
You gentlemen have a great night.
He hurried away before they could respond, his shoulders hunched underneath the unseen gaze he'd felt since that day in the gentleman's club. Rian walked on, oblivious of the people he passed, oblivious of the drunken sway that he took with each step. His thoughts were on the coin, on the flickering torch, the smiling night walker. Had he just imagined it? He had been telling himself that of course he'd imagined it, and had even almost managed to believe it, almost managed to convince himself that the eyes he felt following him wherever he went were nothing more than paranoia, a perfectly reasonable paranoia, really, for a man leading two very separate lives. But then the cards. 10 hands in a row. 10 in a damned night-cursed row. He kept walking, choosing streets at random, letting his feet lead the way. He didn't know how long he walked, but after a time he stopped, a feeling of vague alarm working its way past his distraction. At first, he didn't know the cause of his unease. Then he looked around and realized that he was the only one in the street. It was late, but even at this hour there should have been someone. Beggars pleading for coins, whores hawking their wares, even pickpockets going about their nightly errands. But there was no one. The street, as much as he could see of it in the poor light cast by the torches ensconced on the walls of several nearby buildings, was empty. A street in the slums was never empty at night. After all, that's when most of its people went to work. Never unless... Damn. He turned and started back the way he'd come, his footfalls echoing in the unnatural quiet.
Not so fast there, Rian. Someone said in a rough, gravelly voice.
A voice, God's help him, that he recognized. Any doubts he might have had were dispelled as the speaker emerged from the shadows of an alley a short distance up ahead, flanked by two thickly muscled men. Rian cursed himself for a fool. He'd allowed himself to become distracted, ignoring his surroundings. In the slums, people died for less. Knowing it was useless, he turned and hurried in the opposite direction, but was brought up short when two more men appeared out of the shadows. Rian glanced back and forth between the two groups. Besides the owner of the voice, each of the others carried a short, cruel-looking club. Bruises, their malformed noses and cauliflower ears badges of their experience. Night, take it. Slowly, he reached his hand into his tunic, searching for the handle of one of the blades he had secreted there. The man who'd spoken smiled.
I wouldn't do that if I were you, Rian. Whiskers over there might get nervous and accidentally let fly with one of those bolts in his crossbow. Isn't that right, Whiskers?
Yes, sir, boss.
A voice called from the darkness to Rian's left.
I'm a right twitchy bastard.
Rion forced a nonchalant sigh as he drew his hand out of his tunic, struggling to keep his voice calm and matter-of-fact. What do you want, Sigyn? Sigyn grinned, rolling his neck around on his massive shoulders. As big as the bruisers he employed were, the crime lord was bigger. In the orange glow of the torches, the thick, jagged scar that ran around his throat stood out pale and white. It was said that when he was still climbing through the ranks of the criminal underworld, a fellow criminal had tried to assassinate Sigyn, had, in fact, gone so far as to slit his throat. Instead of cooperating and dying, however, Sigyn had turned on the man and killed him with his bare hands before going and killing his entire family. Rion supposed that he must have gotten his throat stitched up at some point, but he'd never heard that part of the story. He supposed it wasn't really necessary. There were thousands of tales in the slums, and most of those were lies, but Rion had always believed that one. Sigyn had been an orphan when he was young, with no one to look out for him, and it took a great amount of skill and toughness just to survive in the streets, let alone excel and carve out a place for yourself as one of the city's most powerful crime lords. As for intelligence, well, most people, on seeing Sigyn's rough appearance, would have assumed he was stupid, a man of violence who gave little thought to anything beyond his next drink or his last fight. Unfortunately, they would be wrong.
"What do I want?"
the big man asked, his words returning Rion to the present, his grin stretching the scar on his neck into a smile of its own.
"Well, I just want to talk. After all, you haven't come to see me in a while, have you, Rion? Whiskers and the lads are good enough sorts, but not the type for intelligent conversation."
Rion glanced behind him. The bruisers were standing still, watching the proceedings. Apparently they were in no hurry. And why would they be? They knew they had him. He sighed and turned back to Sigyn. The last thing you wanted to do with a man like Sigyn was show weakness. That was one of the first lessons the streets had taught him. "I've been busy."
"Oh?"
the big man asked, bringing a hand to his chest in mock hurt.
"Too busy to come and see your old friend?"
The second lesson the streets had taught Rion was that it never hurt to show a man respect, but it often hurt not to. A good lesson, an important one. The problem was he was angry. Angry with a city that let criminals like Sigyn prosper, while honest people like his mother and father ran a serious risk of losing their home. Angry with a world where walking through the woods at night was worth a man's life, and most of all angry with himself for being caught so unaware. He was tired, and he was angry, and just then he didn't give a damn about respect. "Fuck you, Sigyn." The crime lord's smile faded, and the thick muscles of his chest shifted like slabs of rock beneath his jerkin.
"Fine. Enough of the pleasantries. You owe me, and you're late. You do know what I do to people who don't give me what I'm owed, don't you, Rion?"
Rion didn't bother answering. Everyone in the poor district knew what happened to such people. They, or what was left of them, were often found in some back alley or street corner, their worldly concerns far behind them.
"You see, Rion," Sigyn said, stalking closer, "I'm perplexed. I mean, the gods know you're a clever bastard, so it seems strange to me that you would put yourself in this position. And then, to make matters worse, when I send Pelham and Darby to give you a friendly reminder about what you owe, you send them back with the shit beat out of them. Night, Darby's hand is so wrecked I don't imagine he'll ever lift a club again. You tell me, Rion, what good's a bruiser can't lift a club?"
Rion shrugged. "Not much, I guess." Sigyn barked a laugh.
"Not much? Yeah, that's about right. The bastard was useless."
He shrugged.
"So I had one of the boys slit his throat and dump him. He wasn't any good to me, you see. He was a waste of my time. And I think you know what I do to people and things that waste my time. Oh, Rion, I must admit that I'm a bit upset with you. Darby was a fool, true. the kind of man who would piss in the wind and call it rain, but he was my fool. Do you understand?
Rian nodded.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Sigyn laughed again.
My, but you are a cocky little bastard, aren't you? I like that. Tell you what, Rian, you give me that money you owe me, plus a bit extra for what you cost me in training another bruiser, and maybe I'll let you walk away from here with nothing more than a smashed-up hand, a memento to remember Darby by.
He held up a hand, forestalling Rian from answering.
Take a moment. Consider it.
Rian took his moment. The truth was, he had the money to pay Sigyn back several times over. His luck at dicing and cards had seen to that. Problem was, his family needed that money. Never mind the fact that, whatever he said, Sigyn wouldn't let Rian walk away, smashed up hand or not. He turned back to the crime lord and shook his head. No, thanks. For the first time, the crime lord looked angry. No, not angry, furious. His face went a deep scarlet, and his chest began to heave with his building rage.
No one steals from me and lives. No one. Enough. Whiskers, plug the bastard.
Rian dived to the side, but he was too slow, and he grunted as the arrow struck him like a fist, knocking him to the ground. Hissing with pain, he looked down, expecting to see the wooden shaft sticking out of his stomach. Instead, it lay broken on the road beside him. How in the name of the gods, he thought, confused. It hit me. I know it hit me. He glanced at his stomach, and sure enough there was a hole in his tunic. Through the hole, he could just make out the shimmer of coins. Apparently the arrow had struck the leather pouch of coins nestled in his tunic, and somehow been turned. What are the odds? He thought wildly, as he struggled to his feet. Again, the knowing, amused laughter sounded in his head, and he fought it down with a will. He couldn't afford to go crazy, not yet. He was still alive, but he wouldn't be for much longer if he didn't do something. He jumped to his feet and sprinted at the man who'd shot the arrow.
Get that bastard!
Sigyn roared. But Rian didn't take the time to look back. He rolled as the wide-eyed bowman released another shot, and the arrow flew over his head. Before he could load another bolt, Rian was on him, burying one of his knives in the man's chest while the other traced a red line across his throat. He was leaping over the corpse even before it hit the ground, dashing into the alleyway, his arm clasped tightly around his bruised stomach.
You're dead, Rian!
Sigyn screamed from somewhere behind him.
Do you hear me? You're dead!
Rian ran on, ducking through alleyways and side streets, the footsteps of his pursuers echoing loudly in the still night air, so that it seemed as if he were being chased by an army instead of a four-man squad of bruisers. He flew around a corner, taking it so quickly that he stumbled and slammed into the alley wall, hissed a curse, and ran on. After a few more paces, he risked a glance behind him, and saw that the men were close behind.
The bastards are faster than they have a right to be, he thought,
gritting his teeth at the pain in his stomach as he rushed on. He ran faster, his heart hammering in his chest, and managed to put some distance between him and his pursuers. He came to an intersection and stopped long enough to kick open the door of an inn that stood on the corner of the street, before darting down the opposite side street. His lungs burned, and his stomach ached as if someone had taken a hammer to it, but he kept going, turning left, rushing down an alley, finally stumbling out onto one of the slum's main streets. He was so focused on putting one foot in front of the other that he didn't see the man standing in the street until he barreled into him. It was like running into a brick wall, and he rebounded with a grunt, hitting the cobblestone path hard. Rian looked up, expecting to see one of the bruisers standing over him, and was amazed to recognize a familiar face instead.
Oh, Odric?
The blacksmith frowned, squinting at the figure in tattered clothing and faded cloak.
How do you... Wait a minute, the man said in surprise. Eriandrian, is that you?
Rian glanced at the blacksmith then, at the covered cart and horse that he was leading, suddenly suspicious.
What are you doing out here?
The big man gestured at the empty cart and horse.
I'm just coming back from delivering an order, he said.
Then he narrowed his gaze on Rian.
What are you doing here?
And in those there's no time, Rian said, glancing at the alley behind him where, any second, the bruisers would appear.
Listen, Odric, you have to hide me.
The big man's brow drew down in confusion, and he glanced down the alleyway. Finally, he nodded slowly, turning back to Rian.
Hop in. The cover should keep anyone from looking, and no one will suspect anything. They're used to seeing me by now.
Rian hesitated. There was something strange, something suspicious about seeing the blacksmith here, in the slums. Why would a man whose father was one of the city's richest commoners make a delivery to the poor district in the middle of the night? Rian glanced uncertainly between the cart and the alleyway. He was still considering when he heard the sound of nearby shouts. He cursed and dove into the cart, pulling the cloth cover tight behind him. Once he was inside, Odric clucked to the horse, and the cart began rolling forward. They'd only gone a short distance when someone shouted,
"Hey, blacksmith!"
The cart slowed, then stopped, and Rian tensed, drawing two of his daggers once more. Odric had seemed like a good friend to him, but if living in Valeria had taught him anything, it was that you couldn't trust anybody, and that everybody, even the rich, no, especially the rich, did most of the things they did because of greed.
"Yes?" Odric asked.
Rian peeked out the sliver of opening the covered canvas afforded, but he could make out nothing except the blacksmith's wide back.
"Have you seen anybody running through here?"
the voice, no doubt one of the bruisers, asked. Odric nodded, and Rian cursed under his breath.
"Yeah," the blacksmith said. "I saw him. He ran down that way."
The blacksmith turned, revealing one of the bruisers from before as he pointed down a nearby alleyway.
"Shit,"
the other man cursed, starting away.
"Hey, what's this all about?"
Odric asked.
"Is something wrong?"
"You damned fool,"
Rian thought. The man stopped and looked back.
"None of your damned business, blacksmith," he snapped. "Now get on your way."
He didn't wait for an answer before turning and sprinting toward the alley. Odric nodded.
"Yes, sir,"
he said to the departing man's back. Then he clucked at the horse again and the cart lurched into motion. Rian didn't dare speak for fear of someone hearing him, so he rode in silence, his daggers clutched in sweaty hands, the only sounds the clip-clop of the horse's hooves on the cobbles, and the rapid thumping of his own heart as they made their way through the city. After what felt like a lifetime, the cart rolled to a stop. The blacksmith spoke with someone, and after another moment, he lifted the covering off the tarp, and Rian winced as lantern light pierced his eyes.
"You can come out," Odric said.
Warily, Rian climbed out of the cart. He glanced around, half expecting to find himself a prisoner at one of Sigyn's hideouts. Instead, he was surprised to find himself standing in a stable.
"Where are we?"
The blacksmith turned from where he'd been unfastening the horse from the cart, a slightly amused expression on his face, as if he knew what Rian had been thinking.
"My father's stables. He doesn't much care for riding, but we need the horses to carry supplies to customers."
"Why?
Where did you think we would be?"
Rian shrugged, but didn't answer, glancing around the stalls.
"You don't have to worry," Odric said. "No one's here. I sent Michael away."
"Who's Michael?"
"The groom that looks after the horses. I thought that maybe you wouldn't want to be seen."
Rian nodded. "Thanks." He studied the blacksmith, searching for any kind of deceit, but if the man's open face hid any, he could not see it.
"Why were you in the poor district?"
Odric shrugged.
"I make a lot of trips to the poor district to carry some of my father's goods to his customers. Nails, horseshoes, that kind of thing."
Rian frowned. "Doesn't your father have other people to do that for him?" The blacksmith began busying himself, unhitching the cart, an embarrassed expression on his face.
"He does," Odric admitted after a moment. "But..."
Rian raised an eyebrow at his hesitation, and the big man heaved a sigh.
"I volunteer to do it sometimes," he said,
his voice reluctant but resigned like a murderer that had been caught out and had no choice but to confess.
"Volunteer?"
Rian asked, incredulous.
"Why?"
Odric shrugged as he began leading the horse into one of the stalls.
I enjoy it.
You enjoy it? The blacksmith nodded as he locked the gate. Then he turned and met Rion's eyes, a challenging look in his gaze.
Yes.
And so what?
The truth is, we don't make much off of the orders in the poor district. People there barely have enough money to eat and don't go about spending what little they do have on elaborate candle holders or swords. While the rich, he said, pointedly looking at Rion, spend their times figuring out which ball they're going to attend. These people are trying to figure out where their next meal is coming from.
I know the feeling, Rion thought. But the man wasn't finished yet.
They care about simple things like nails or horseshoes or getting their oxen chain repaired. You may not understand it, but my dad has been dealing with a lot of these people since I was a child, long before he ever gained his fortune. I know most of the nobles think that everyone in the slums is a criminal, but that isn't true. Most of them are just people, good people that work long hours for little pay and try to provide for their families.
Rion nodded slowly, taken aback. He'd known Odric for years, and never before had he heard the quiet man say so much at once. He doubted anyone had. The earnestness in his friend's expression, and the sharp look he gave Rion, daring him to argue, was almost enough to convince him that the man's story was the truth. Almost. That still doesn't explain why you were in the slums instead of one of your father's workers. The blacksmith shrugged again.
You wouldn't understand.
Try me. And if you answer wrong, Rion thought, grimly crossing his arms so that his right hand rested on the handle of a blade hidden beneath his tunic, then I think we're both in for a bad night. Odric hesitated for a moment, then sighed, nodding.
It's just that when I'm at a ball around nobles, I always know I don't belong. It's like trying to fit a hammer on a sword rack. Sure, the hammer's practical. More practical, really. But you don't see people hanging those on their mantles, do you? I know I don't belong, and they know it too. I'm not like them, and they know it, and they hate me for it. Just like the way Severin talks, not all nobles are like Severin. Aren't they?
The blacksmith asked again, frowning.
They care only about themselves, about their own families and their own concerns, without giving so much as a second thought to anybody else.
Rion thought of how, just a moment ago, he'd been ready to kill the blacksmith in order to keep his secret safe, and felt his face heat with shame.
But I can't blame them, really, the blacksmith said, heaving a sigh. After all, my father always said that money makes men crazy, and the nobles have a lot of it. Who knows, in another year or two, I might be just the same.
Oh, it's not the money, Odric, Rion thought sadly. We were crazy long before that. And no, I don't think you will. Do you deliver your father's goods a lot?
Odric shook his head. Not a lot. Most of the time I just help him in the shop.
And do you always go out so late at night?
No, the big man said, shaking his head thoughtfully. I never have before. In fact, I should have been finished hours ago, but one of the wheels broke off the wagon, and I had to fix it. I'd only just finished my delivery when I ran into you. What are the chances, right?
Rion thought he heard the ghostly laughter again, but it was faint and gone so quickly that he could have imagined it.
Eriandrian, Odric asked. If you don't mind me asking, what were you doing in the slums? And what happened to your clothes? More importantly, who were those men chasing you?
Rion studied the man's face for a moment, trying to decide what to do. He could lie and say that an errand had taken him through the slums, and that he'd been set on by thieves or muggers, a common enough occurrence in the poor district of Valeria. But that would do nothing to explain his tattered clothing. If he didn't tell Odric the truth, he ran the risk of the man figuring out some other way, and maybe even inadvertently betraying Rion's secret identity to others. The thought of Sigyn, a man known for his ruthlessness, Finding out his true identity sent chills running down his spine, and not just for him, but for his parents. Against all of his instincts, Rion decided to gamble with Odric's trust. After all, what other choice did he have? He took a deep breath and began to explain everything to the blacksmith, telling of how his father's fortune had collapsed, and continuing with his own forays into the slums. The big man listened quietly, not interrupting, and as he spoke, Rion began to feel as if a great weight had been lifted from his shoulders, as if the very act of telling someone else of his struggles took some of the burden away. When he was finished, the blacksmith stood silently for several seconds, thinking, as was his way.
"Are you serious, Eriandrian? This is all true?"
"It's true."
"Why didn't you ask me for help sooner?
Business is good between the nobles and making weapons for the city guard. My father and I have more work than we can handle.
I'm sure once I explain to him what's happened, we can help you—"
"No!" Rion half shouted, and the blacksmith's eyes went wide in surprise. "No one can know, Odric," he went on, making an effort to keep his tone calm. "No one. My father worked all of his life to build his fortune, and my mother always stood beside him. Do you have any idea what kind of shame this would bring them? Besides, it's too far gone for that now. That man you saw before worked for Sigyn, one of the crime lords in the slums, and he isn't the only one that I owe money to. If they found out that the man they know as Rion was also Eriandrian Tyrinian, heir to the Tyrinian house—"
"It would be bad," the blacksmith finished, swallowing hard.
"Yes."
"All right, Eriandrian. I won't tell anyone. But surely there has to be something I can do."
Rion reached back and drew the tattered hood of his cloak over his head once more. "Do you really want to help, Odric?" he asked, studying the man's face carefully. The blacksmith nodded.
"Of course. You're my friend, Eriandrian."
He studied the big man's face for several seconds, then nodded.
"So I am," he thought. "You poor fool."
"Call me Rion," he answered, as he turned and started toward the door. "And if you want to help me, then forget this ever happened."
Chapter 39 Alesh yawned and reluctantly climbed out of his bedroll, his sore muscles groaning in protest. He and the priest had travelled through the woods, avoiding the roads in case more redeemers were searching for them. At first, the sprawling hills, forests, and valleys through which they travelled, so untouched by humans, had seemed beautiful. But after 3 long days spent wading through waist-high undergrowth and being slapped in the face with tree limbs that seemed to attack him out of nowhere, Alesh had had enough of nature. While he nursed his latest thorn-cut or branch lash, the old man walked on like a child in some fairyland, oblivious of the dangers around him, yet managing to never turn his ankle in a hole hidden by leaves, or to trip over rocks covered by the undergrowth, as Alesh did. He suspected that the priest had saved his life by mending his wounds before he bled out, and he was grateful, but that didn't keep him from daydreaming about tripping the old man or pushing him into a thorn bush. It wouldn't be hard to find one. During his time in the woods, Alesh had discovered that he had a particular knack for it.
"Ah, you're awake. Good morning."
Alesh turned to see the priest standing a short distance away, looking bright-eyed and wide awake. Alesh yawned, rubbing at his eyes. How the man always seemed so happy, so tireless, was beyond him. If the old priest slept, Alesh had never seen it. He was always awake when Alesh went to sleep, and awake when he awoke. Alesh grunted noncommittally. The priest smiled.
"If you will pack the bedrolls and supplies, I'll go and see about getting us some breakfast."
Alesh glanced at the spread-out bedrolls, and then at the blazing white fire. Although the corpses had been gone when he awoke after the nightling attack, and although he still couldn't get a straight answer out of the priest on something so simple as what his name was, much less what had happened to all of them, the priest had somehow managed to keep the tunic and belt the Lightbringer had carried, a fact that had kept them breathing until now, which meant that the man hadn't saved his life once, but 2 times. Still,
He'd be damned if he was going to spend another morning playing housemaid. I've packed the camp and put out the fire for the last 3 days, while you wade in a nice cool creek and toss a couple of fish out. How about this time you pack our gear, and I'll get breakfast?
The priest smiled and nodded, as if excited by the idea.
The bastard.
Certainly, the old man said, and with that he set about packing their gear.
Alesh frowned. One of the most infuriating things about the old man was that he was just so damned agreeable. It wasn't natural, and when the man started whistling, damn it, as if there was nowhere he'd rather be than in the woods, and nothing he'd rather be doing than packing their bags, Alesh began to suspect that he'd been tricked somehow. He was tempted to let the old man do the fishing after all, but what kept him from it was that he was absolutely certain that the priest would be just as happy with that as well. Alesh didn't consider himself a violent man, but that kind of happy could drive a man to murder. He glanced at the old man, who had stopped packing long enough to run a wrinkled hand gently, almost reverently, over several blades of grass, and, frowning, set off toward the creek. An hour later, he was still standing in the freezing creek, his soggy trouser legs clinging against his skin, cursing and pawing at the water with hands that had long since gone numb. He heard a cough, and turned to see the priest standing on the bank.
"Would you like some help?"
"No, thank you," Alesh said, his teeth gritted to keep them from chattering. He took a slow, deep breath, and, for what had to have been the 100th time, began to let his fingertips trail in the cool, bubbling water of the creek as he'd seen the priest do. After a moment, he sensed more than felt something in the water, and he plunged his hands into the creek, sending water showering around him. Something slick, almost oily, rubbed against his fingers. He grasped at it, but it slipped from his grip. He pawed around, turning frantically this way and that, but found nothing.
"Night, take it," he growled.
He shot a look at the priest, but the man was pointedly looking away from him, appearing to be studying the bark of a nearby tree.
"Smug bastard."
Alesh set his feet once more, drew a slow, deep breath, and forced himself to be still. He'd been close that time, damned close. All he had to do was be patient. In another minute, maybe two, he would pull a massive fish out of the water, bigger than any the old man had caught.
See how he likes that.
Grinning at the thought of it, he let his hands sink slowly into the water once more and waited. 15 minutes later, he half stomped, half sloshed out of the water to where the priest still stood, shivering with cold.
"I'm not very hungry anyway,"
he said, scowling, daring the man to say something.
"Are you ready?"
The priest smiled, grabbing his own bedroll and handing Alesh his.
"Of course."
"How much farther before we reach Valeria?" Alesh thought he saw the old man's smile falter for a moment at mention of the city, but it was back in another instant.
"A few days, no more," the man said,
before turning and starting off into the woods. Alesh nodded and followed after. A few more days. A good thing, considering that the supplies in the Lightbringer's belt were getting worryingly low. If they didn't reach shelter soon, they'd be forced to spend the night with nothing but a plain wood fire to keep the nightlings at bay. Not a comforting thought. Ahead, the priest began to whistle as if he was out for a morning stroll, and Alesh gritted his teeth. If they didn't make it to other people soon, he might just give the Nightwalkers a try.
Chapter 40
Catherine. She opened her eyes and found herself standing alone in the middle of a grassy field. She turned, looking around her for the sound of the voice, but there was only the dew-covered grass, greener than any she'd ever seen, stretching on in every direction like a sea of emeralds, sparkling and shimmering in the morning sun. Her skin broke out into goose flesh.
How had she gotten here?
"You're dreaming, that's all. Just dreaming like you've done 1,000 times before." And it was true, had to be true, but if it was a dream, it was of a different kind than any she'd ever had. She could feel each strand of grass as it brushed against her bare toes, could feel the heat of the sun and the kiss of a gentle breeze on her face.
"Catherine,"
someone whispered in her ear, so close that she could feel breath on her neck.
She let out a cry of surprise and whipped around, but there was no one there. She was still looking for who'd spoken when, behind her, soft music began to play. She looked at the direction it was coming from and gasped. In the distance, a tree stood where nothing had been only moments before. It was short enough, no more than 4 or 5 times as tall as a man, but its trunk was incredibly thick, at least 10 feet, and its full leafy branches stretched out in all directions, as if it reached not for the sun, but for the land itself. Squinting, she could just make out the vague shape of a figure seated beneath the tree, and though she could see only a shadowed outline, something about that figure made Catherine's heart hammer in her chest like a drum. The breeze grew stronger, and on it drifted the sound of a melody so achingly sweet, so alive, that Catherine felt a tear slide down her cheek. Unnerved but unable to help herself, Catherine took one step and then another. The world shifted and blurred around her, and suddenly she was right in front of the tree and the figure sitting beneath it. She staggered, disoriented, and almost fell before the strength came back in her legs, and she managed to catch herself. Now that she was closer, Catherine could see that the figure was seated in a flawless white throne, so fine and regal that it would have been at home in chosen Alaysia's own castle. The woman who sat in it wore a golden dress that glowed brilliantly, so that it seemed as if she were covered in sunlight. Her long, graceful fingers plucked the strings of a pearl-white harp, and it was from this that the music came. Catherine opened her mouth to speak, but found that no words would come, so she just stood there, listening, carried on the harp's melody, buoyed by it. She had never heard anything so beautiful. She didn't know how much time passed, but eventually the song drew to a close, and the woman withdrew her fingers from the harp, the last note hanging in the air like the promise of spring in winter. The woman glanced up from beneath a thick mane of luscious golden hair, displaying a face so perfect that it didn't look like that of a living being at all, but the fanciful creation of some master sculptor. "Catherine," the woman said, her voice possessing a lilting, musical quality of its own. "You have come." "Mistress?" Catherine asked in a whisper, as the last hint of the harp's final note drifted away on the cool breeze. "Please, don't stop playing on my account. It was beautiful." The woman smiled a slow, almost sad smile. "It was, wasn't it? Still, all songs must come to an end, and the time for playing is nearly finished. You know that, don't you, Catherine?" "Ma'am?" Catherine asked, confused. "We don't know each other, do we? Surely I would remember." "Oh," the woman said, waving a delicate hand in a gesture of dismissal. "You know me, Catherine, and I have known you for a very, very long time. But let us leave that for now. Tell me, are you going to meet Alaysia in Valeria?" Catherine's shock at the unexpected question must have shown on her face, because the blonde-haired woman smiled again, running thin, delicate fingers through her golden hair. "Ah, yes, I know of your mission. Now—" She cut off, as thunder, loud and terrible, echoed in the distance. Frowning, the woman gazed over Catherine's shoulder. Catherine turned to look, and saw that shifting black storm clouds had begun to form on the horizon. "Quickly, Catherine," the woman said, her voice tight with what sounded like fear. "There is not much time. You are going, yes?" Yes, ma'am." The words were out of her mouth before she considered. "Mistress Alaysia has sent me a letter—" "I know of it," the woman said, waving her hand again. "And it is good that you go. I sense a gathering of sorts there, though for good or ill I cannot say. Perhaps my father could, but light help us he is." She paused and shook her head. "It does not matter. It is enough for now that you are going. I—" Whatever else the woman said was drowned out by the roar of nearby thunder, so powerful that it seemed to shake the ground beneath Catherine's feet. The woman's frown deepened, and worry lines creased her perfect brow.
"And so it begins," she said in a soft whisper, filled with regret.
The clearing grew dark, the gathering clouds blotting out the sun,
and Catherine shivered as an unexpected chill came over her. She was suddenly overcome by the certainty that something terrible was coming, and a part of her wanted nothing more but to turn and run. Instead, she took a slow breath, watched it plume in front of her face like